The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I talked about judgment, and this week I thought I'd talk a little bit about the self-directed version of that in the negative form. The self-negativity, all those kinds of patterns that we have around judging ourselves and criticizing ourselves, even to the point of self-hatred. So I thought I'd just explore that terrain a little bit today. There's a story from the time of the Buddha. There were a king and a queen who were disciples of the Buddha. And at one point, the king came to the queen and said to her, "Is there anyone that you love or that you hold more dear than you hold yourself?" And she responded that no, that she didn't hold anyone more dear than she held herself. And she turned to the king and said, "And how about you? You know, what about you? How is it for you?" And he said the same thing. And then the king said, "Well, let's go and ask the Buddha about this." You know, thinking perhaps that they were supposed to love somebody more dearly than themselves. And when they went and talked to the Buddha, he responded with a poem. He said, "Searching all directions with one's awareness, one find no one dearer than oneself. In the same way, others are fiercely dear to themselves. So one should not hurt others if one loves oneself." And so this notion of loving ourselves, of holding ourselves dear, was understood by the Buddha to be a very natural course of events. That it would, of course, you would hold yourself dear. And yet somehow in the West, we seem to have had another strain come into our experience that is quite the opposite. Many of you may have heard the story of the Dalai Lama. I think it was early in the time when after Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts was created. So it was probably about 30 years ago, maybe 25 years ago or so, the Dalai Lama came to visit at the Insight Meditation Society. I think this is where this story happened. And somebody in the audience at the Insight Meditation Center raised their hand and said, "You know, what do I do about these feelings of self-hatred? And what do I do about this feeling that I just don't like myself and don't feel like I'm a good person?" And apparently the Dalai Lama, in, you know, having this translated, it had to be translated, and in going through the translator, he was confused. And he had to go back and forth several times with the translator to find out, in fact, indeed, what the person was saying. I think he couldn't believe what the person was saying. And he went around and asked other people, and is this true for you too? And he found out that there were a number of people in the room for whom this experience was the case, and he was shocked. So I think there is something in our Western culture that brings this strain in. It seemed to be kind of a surprise to the Dalai Lama coming from the Tibetan culture that this would even be possible, that we wouldn't like ourselves. And so this is a thread, or more than a thread, perhaps an ocean of experience that we need to work with, and that we can work with. So there's so many different kinds of this kind of self-negativity, and I named a few of them. And they range. They range from kind of the subtle end of things, where it just might be a kind of a self-judgment of, oh, that person knows better than me. You know, that can be really subtle like that. that person knows better than me. And you know, in that realm, and I'll cover this, I'll get into this a little bit more later, in that realm, we may think that we're actually seeing things clearly, you know, that there is a discernment that goes on. There's the comparison of, our minds are set up to compare. They're set up to discern something's larger or smaller, something has more capacity or less capacity. We're set up to discern that kind of thing. And that discernment quickly moves into judgment, that one is better than the other for some reason or another. And so we may, you know, comparing ourselves with another, legitimately recognize that person is better than math that I am. That person has more capacity for that, has more capacity for that ability than I do. But we may also then add a judgment to it. You know, that means that person is better than I am, or there's some way that I'm less than. You know, so we denigrate ourselves. So there's a little bit of aversiveness, a little bit of a negative spin to that discernment. And that's when it moves into self-judgment. So it can be really subtle like that, where it's almost not even obvious and not even clear to us that it's a judgment on ourselves, because it seems so closely connected with the way things are. Well, of course that person is better at math than I am. I mean, that's obvious. But the added piece of somehow denigrating ourselves for that, that's this quality of the self-negativity. That it's actually optional. It's not necessary. But we confuse that. We confuse the discerning and discriminating with the judging. And it can be subtle like that, or it can be as full-blown as something like self-hatred, feelings of unworthiness, of feelings of self-anger. So this is a pattern in my own experience that I'm quite familiar with. I've had a lot of this. It was a surprise to me, actually. You know, when I first started hearing people, teachers, talk about self-judgment and self-negativity, I thought, oh, I don't have any of that. That's not my experience. And then I began recognizing what my mind did. I mean, on one retreat, I remember, you know, something really simple happened. Like, I forgot to do my yogi job. You know, when you go on retreats, you participate in the retreat by taking a job to do, helping in the kitchen or cleaning the bathrooms or something like that. And I had a job, and I was doing that job. And then somebody left the retreat, and I signed up to do a second job. And for a few days, I remembered it. And then one day, I forgot. I forgot to do that job. And it was so amazing to see how much criticism I directed at myself. It was like, wow, this is amazing. It was quite strong. It was quite powerful. And it really, I think for me, it took being a little more settled and quiet before I began to recognize, oh, these things are you know, really hostile. These kinds of words and statements are really hostile. We having a certain pattern or way of navigating the world, sometimes it's just so familiar to us, we don't recognize it as hostile or struggling or suffering. So it was eye-opening to me. And then when I began to see it, I saw how I did it all over the place. I mean, I would hear myself saying, "You're so stupid! You're so stupid! Why did you do that? You're so dumb! You're a failure! You can't do, you're no good!" Those kinds of thoughts were just rampant. It was quite amazing. So I've had a lot of experience working with this kind of thought. And it, you know, sometimes this kind of pattern, you know, strong self-negative patterns, can often go back to childhood, can often go back to perhaps a feeling of not being seen or witnessed as a child, of not being met as a child. And so they can run very deep. They can be very deeply ingrained, these kinds of patterns. And so they are a challenge. And the feelings are are painful, very painful, when we actually begin to open up to the feeling. I began to see how much I did to avoid that feeling, how much I kind of would prop myself up. It's like, okay, no, I'm actually really good at this. So the willingness to be able to begin to meet the experience of self-hatred or unworthiness, the stronger flavors of this, it can take a lot of courage because it feels so threatening. It feels like we're going to disappear or disintegrate if we go into those feelings or allow those feelings to be there. It just feels so wrong. It really feels like something is really radically wrong when we have those feelings. And yet, it's interesting in a way, we are kind of attached to them. Partly, it's not necessarily an attachment that's a kind of a conscious kind of thing, but it's an attachment of belief and it's attachment of pattern. It's attachment of almost familiarity, that this is the way I know. This is the way I know how to navigate the world. So the first way to begin to work with this kind of pattern, either the small, the subtle, or the large, is to just begin to recognize them, to recognize that they're happening, to acknowledge that, yes, this is a pattern that's happening. Get to know the various flavors of this kind of self-negativity. And get to know the thoughts that are the kind of signal or flag that says I'm here. You know, the thoughts of you're a failure, you're no good, you're stupid. It's really harsh language we can use in our own minds. It's not what you would call wise discerning judgment. It's really helpful to see if you can begin to tease it out, because often there is something that's happened where perhaps you've done something wrong or you've made a mistake or something, and that's where this blame comes in, this self-blame comes in. You know, so sometimes we just do it out of nothing. You know, sometimes we'll just decide we're a failure and there's absolutely nothing happening about anything that proves it, but we decide we're a failure anyway. But often there is something that's happened. You know, maybe we've said something that was a little bit off, or you know, there's just something. And we kind of have this pattern or belief perhaps or something along those lines that we think we need to be hard on ourselves so that we won't do it again. It's kind of like self-punishment. It's like, okay, you know, well, I did that thing and it wasn't so good. And so I really need to beat myself up. I mean, we don't do this consciously, but you know, I need to beat myself up so that I won't do this again. I kind of saw this in my own experience at some point. It's like, oh, this self-judgment, it's kind of like, it almost felt like it was the thing I was supposed to be doing. You know, like I was supposed to be judging myself and telling myself I did it wrong, because obviously I did do it wrong. I made a mistake. Somebody got hurt. And the way of doing that was to kind of say, well, you're no good, you're bad, you shouldn't do that kind of thing. And what we can do instead is just acknowledge that was a mistake. What we have trouble doing in our culture, I think, is acknowledging mistakes without hating ourselves for it, without being hard on ourselves for it. And there's a quality in Buddhist psychology that is, it's kind of a skillful remorse, that we acknowledge, yes, that was unskillful. But it doesn't have the guilt associated with it. It's more of a, okay, I need to acknowledge that that was unskillful and perhaps move forward from here, resolving to try to not do that again, perhaps making amends for an action that would harm others. And we can do that without hating ourselves for it. And for us, it seems like almost impossible to separate the two. For many people, it seems hard to separate the two. But that's an area of exploration. How can we acknowledge our mistakes and yet not be self, be angry at ourselves for having made a mistake, but use that that mistake as an opportunity to learn, to move forward, to hopefully make more skillful choices in the future. So getting to know how your mind does this, you know, getting to know how your mind does this kind of reactivity. Does it happen with this kind of situation where there's something that you do? Maybe it's a small thing. You know, maybe it's a way that you close the door when you walk into the meditation hall. And then you realize, oh, it was too loud. And then, oh, that was so stupid, you know. I should have closed it really carefully. And we beat ourselves up. I mean, it might be a really small thing that mushrooms into this self-hostility. Or it could be something larger. So beginning to notice when we're leaping off of some place where perhaps there could have been a slightly more skillful action or a way more skillful action, and when we are directing hostility towards ourselves, anger towards ourselves, aversion towards ourselves, and seeing if you can recognize the distinction between the recognition of the action as perhaps being unskillful and the aversion that creates in the mind towards ourselves. And in that recognition of that aversion, the most important piece is to simply, can you be aware of it? As the beginning exploration, it's mindfulness. Can we recognize these states? You know, mindfulness is such a powerful quality. It and I think with these difficult states, particularly some of the stronger states of self-negativity, like self-hatred and unworthiness, we can have a feeling of fear of turning our attention towards them because they are so painful and they are so threatening. And so there's kind of a trust that we begin over time to develop in the mindfulness, that with mindfulness, the mindfulness can create a little space around the difficulty, create some space around the negativity, around the self-aversion, and allow us to simply watch it without engaging in it. So this takes some trust because often the way we've met that self-negativity is with engagement. You know, we just continue to spin the gears. It's kind of like, you know, the pattern is one where there's strong, it's like there's a strong gear connection there. And the spinning of the gears, they're engaged. And the fact that they're engaged means that they're powering each other, so that the pattern just keeps cycling. There's the feeling of the thing that we did, the recognition of that, and then there's the blame or the judgment around it. And then it goes back and looks back and says, but I could have done it better, and then there's judgment about that, and then there's other ways we look, and I could have done it, and it just keeps, it's like these gears are engaged and they're just spinning together. And what mindfulness starts to do is to disengage those gears. It doesn't stop the gears from spinning, but it keeps them from feeding themselves. It keeps the pattern from feeding itself. It's kind of like You know, being in a car, if you're in a car on the freeway and you're going 60 miles an hour and you put the car in neutral, the car doesn't stop immediately. But it will stop eventually because we're not engaging the gears anymore. And mindfulness kind of functions like that, that it's kind of like putting our minds into neutral. It doesn't stop those things from being there, but it does allow that disengagement to happen. So it does take some trust. It does take some trust to meet these kinds of feelings. It takes some courage. It takes some courage to meet these kinds of feelings because they are so threatening. By their very nature, you know, they are self-annihilatory. You know, they are denigrating a sense of self. So just beginning to have some trust or confidence that it's okay to allow these feelings and see what happens when allowing these feelings. So it's probably easiest to start this with some of the smaller kinds. You know, I had some really strong patterns of self-hatred, and you know, sometimes you just have to acknowledge that it's stronger than your ability to be mindful and just to put it aside gently and put your attention elsewhere. Sometimes it is stronger than you can be attentive to. So compassion, bringing compassion when it's not so easy, and just saying, yes, I see this, and you know, I just can't meet this right now, so I'm going to turn my attention to something else. And for me, something more neutral, like, you know, feet on the ground or hearing, something like that, is helpful with this kind of redirecting of the attention. It's really important that this redirecting of the attention isn't done with a sense of anger or aversion towards that feeling. That would just tend to feed it still. So seeing if you can learn ways to set aside, kind of, you know, just like, yeah, I see you, and it's okay that you're there, but I need to put my attention elsewhere right now. Just in a kind of a gentle way, turning away from it. This is actually taught by the Buddha. This is in the suttas, this kind of technique. He teaches a skillful ignoring. And this is what he's talking about, you know. Something is too strong. Just allow it to, it's not that you're trying to repress it or stop it. It's kind of more like you're letting it be there in the background. In the guided meditation, I was suggesting the, you know, having the two things, the hearing and the breathing. And did you get a sense of what it meant to have one be a little more forward in the foreground and one a little more in the background? So it's that kind of thing. It's kind of like, yeah, you can be there, but I'm just not going to put much attention on you right now. We can do that kind of thing with our strong emotions as well, if they've got too much energy in them. So one piece that I found really interesting around this self-negativity in my own practice and my own experience was at some point I began to realize that there was an opposite voice in my head that was telling me that I was a good person, that I could do things really well, that I was a success. And in particular, on one retreat, I noticed this really strongly, that there would be some time where I just couldn't find my breath, or I couldn't pay attention to the walking. My mind was wandering all over the place, and I would hear my mind going, "You're a failure. You just can't do this. You know, you're a bad yogi. You should. You know, everybody else can do this, and you just can't do this." And then, you know, sitting later, I'd feel the breath, and I'd be able to hang out with the breath for a minute or so and be like, "Oh, you're a really good meditator. And you're probably the best meditator here." And it was like these two opposing voices in my mind. And I began to recognize that that voice of the opposite side. You know, in some ways, that didn't have the quality of suffering in the moment. You know, the blame, the telling myself I was a bad person, that I was a failure, that felt really bad. It was obviously suffering. That was really obviously suffering. When I was telling myself I was a good person, that just felt like what it was supposed to be like. That was just, yeah, that was the way it was supposed to be. And so it didn't have that quality of feeling like suffering. But over the course of this retreat, I saw this pattern happen so many times. And at some point it was like, you know, happening like, you know, just one after the other. It'd be I'd be walking and my mind would be wandering and oh, you're a failure. You don't know how to meditate. And then I'd take a step and I could feel the ground. Oh, you're a good yogi. I'd be like, who's speaking here? You know, and I began to realize that the self praise, I'll call it the self praise, was essentially a setup. You know, and people who have perfectionist tendencies may have this in their experience, that there's the kind of, okay, yes, I can do this. And there's this, it's not only just I can do this in this moment, it's I can do this and I need to be able to do this forever. And that's a setup, because we can't do it forever. Anything. Everything is impermanent. So the, you know, the self-praise was really a setup. It was kind of like saying, this is where I'm supposed to be. And when I'm not there, that means that I've failed. I haven't met my own standard. And so I began to realize that the voice of self-praise was the that there was a very tight coupling between them, a very tight coupling between the self-praise and the self-blame. And what I actually needed to pay more attention to and be very vigilant about was to recognize that self-praise, to recognize, oh yeah, that process is happening. So recognizing that, as I began to recognize that oh, I'm a good person, I'm a good yogi. As I began to recognize that and just notice it as, oh, that's just a thought, that's just a process. As I noticed it without investing the belief that it has to be that way, that's essentially, I think, what the mindfulness did around that. So it helped me to recognize I didn't need to invest the belief in being that person. There was a great reduction of the opposing state, of the opposing self-blame, because the setting up wasn't happening. So that was a very interesting place for me to explore. I'm just going to mention one other thing, and then open it up. I've got a more that I can say, but I want to have some opportunity for discussion here. Another thing that has been really important for me around looking at many difficult states of mind, not just the self-negativity, but the self-negativity, and that seems to be helpful, is recognizing when that state is not there. When it's absent, when that kind of experience is not present for us. So sometimes, for some people at least, you know, we may have a kind of an undercurrent, and I definitely had this undercurrent of self-negativity. And it seemed to me that it was kind of always there. That some aspect of, you know, my experience was always touched by that self-negativity. And because of that belief or that view, it's kind of like I found confirmation in my experience that I was a failure. And so the consciously connecting with the times where that feeling isn't there begins to loosen the strings around the identification with that state, or it loosens the strings around the belief that it's always there, that it's somehow that undercurrent is always there. Now, there may be a tendency towards it in our minds. There may be a tendency towards those kind of patterns, and there is a tendency. We all have tendencies towards various patterns. We have our favorite reactivities. All of us have our favorite reactivities, and they are tendencies in our mind, and they may be kind of tendencies in the way our brains are wired because of the ways we've behaved and been conditioned. But when that pattern is not engaged, it's not there. It's actually not there. The potential for it is there, but the experience is not there. And, you know, actually I found something about the brain that I found really, really fascinating is that when a pattern is, you know, certain patterns in the mind, they create particular networks of neurons. You know, so you engage in a particular pattern over and over again, and those networks kind of get strong. Every time that pattern is engaged in, more neurons come to support that network. So this is our feed. This is the gears. You know, this is the gears. You know, it's slower than gears, but it's, you know, every time a pattern is engaged in, the brain seems to recognize, okay, this is an important pattern. Better support this one. So more neurons come in to support it. As a pattern is not engaged in, and this is the neuroscience of it, as the pattern is not engaged in, the brain realizes, oh, that one is less important, and begins to kind of let go of the neural connections that support it. So, you know, just simply the fact that it is not active in the moment allows it to start weakening, which is kind of amazing. And, you know, I've seen this in my own practice that, you know, there have been times where I've been working with a pattern of some kind of negativity, and I'll see it happening, and, you know, just kind of be watching it as it comes and goes. And then at some point, with one particular pattern, I began to recognize I was actually doing the setting aside practice with that one. I was saying, oh, I see you, and yeah, not now. And I see you, and not now. And over the course of the months of doing that particular practice around this pattern of self-negativity, I began to notice it was happening less frequently. It was not happening as much to me. And at some point I realized, wow, it's had not happened in a really long time. And I couldn't even call it up. I couldn't even call up that particular, you know, even the particular person I was angry with, even bringing them into my mind, I couldn't call up that anger anymore. And it had disappeared kind of through this lack of engagement. It was gone. It has stayed gone. It has never returned, that particular pattern of anger. So we can, simply through not engaging, have things fall away. And so this recognizing when the pattern is not active can help support that. It helps us to recognize that it helps to undermine the belief that it is who I am. Essentially, it really helps to undermine the beliefs around the negativity, the self-negativity. And looking at beliefs, looking at what are the beliefs that are operating, you know, if I don't judge myself, then nobody will like me. Or if, you know, it's just that you know, if I don't judge myself and change how I behave, then nobody will like me. Or, you know, just what are the underlying beliefs? And they're going to be different for everybody because of our conditioning, because of how we were raised, because of who we are. The underlying beliefs around these habits of self-negativity will be different for everybody. And so just, you know, exploring. And one way to explore this is to ask the question, and what beliefs are here? You know, another question that is interesting is, what purpose is this serving? What purpose is this self-judgment serving? What purpose is this self-hatred serving? Can begin to kind of go underneath to some of the beliefs that might be not so obvious to us on the surface. I mean, we may well have a belief, yes, I'm a failure in that moment, but there's often something deeper underneath, some deeper belief. And for me, a lot of that belief was, I have to be perfect. I have to be perfect so that people will love me. And that fed into this whole pattern of self-negativity. So, I'll just open it up for some comments or questions.
Well, other than, I'm not sure I have a real comment other than to say, I think you were talking about me this morning. But I do notice in myself that I must have, maybe as a kid, as a child, been rewarded by my parents for beating myself up to show that I was trying to,
yes,
to get to that whatever perfection meant, and that I had the right attitude, you know.
Yes.
To do things.
Yeah, it's in our culture. It's deeply in our culture.
Well, as to the culture, and then I'll pass this, seems to me that it's, in the Western culture, it's a combination of our inheritance from John Calvin as interpreted by the Industrial Revolution.
You know, something that, I just read this article recently that was fascinating to me. It has wide implications. In terms of cultural transmission, cultural and behavioral transmission. There is some new research that shows that if your grandfather ate food that led to making him diabetic. So it was this, you know, kind of diabetic. I think this was, this is very broad brush. I don't have the article with me, and I think this is the kind of thing they were talking about. So your grandfather ate some food that led to diabetes. Now, it wasn't the kind of diabetes that was originally, you know, genetic. It's not that kind of diabetes. It's the diabetes comes from eating too much sugar. That the tendency, even if your diet is not out of balance, that the tendency towards that kind of diabetes is passed along through the genes. That there's something that happens that our behavior, what we eat, and I think by implication to some extent, what we do, our choices, are passed along through some very subtle modifications in our genetic experience. And I think this is really interesting. I mean, the implications for this are enormous about, and I think there was even a study about somebody who you know, engaged in very intensive study that somehow that it altered their genes such that their grandchildren, and this is, you know, two generations removed, that the tendency towards having a larger capacity was for study was somehow passed along. And they aren't quite sure how it works. It's not mutation of genes. It seems to be something more in the soup of the DNA somehow. But you know, the implications for this are huge, you know. So how our parents, our grandparents behaved, you know, the familial inheritance of patterns that is so clear, you know, how how it's so, it can be understood as behavioral, you know, that father behaved in some way, so son behaves in the same way, and then that son behaves in the same way. But it also is, apparently, they're teasing apart that some of it is actually transmitted genetically. So how we behave, I think it gets passed on in our culture as well. Yeah. Do you want to say something, Kumi?
Just in our language and attitude. Our language.
Mm-hmm.
Passed on in the language.
That's true. The way we speak. The cultural familiarity of certain patterns of speech, that's true. That does impact how we think about things. And it's, yeah, that's passed on.
Mm-hmm. You made a comment when you first started talking about, you know, the self-criticism and then how that can turn to other people in your life by being judgmental of them. I think you spoke to that. So it's interesting having a 6-year-old and 4-year-old. And I used to be able to laugh at, you know, when they would do something wrong, throwing food on the ground or treat it with a song or a smile. It's interesting, as they get older, my patience has evaporated.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it is the judgment of you're rude and you're going to be a rude kid, you know.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And being able to just notice, and what you said, meet them and hear them, as you spoke about yourself and your childhood experience, which was probably similar to mine, and how easy it is to repeat this pattern.
Yes.
And it's scary.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I don't know. It's...
We can break it. I mean, it's not hardwired, fortunately. I mean, our mental experience, while it can be very strongly conditioned, we do have the opportunity to choose otherwise. And mindfulness is what gives us that wedge, that possibility.
I notice you're taking your shirt off the table, or just noticing?
Well, partly it's noticing your own reactivity and your own impatience around it. So you can set boundaries for your children without having the impatience. So it's not like you just say, oh yes, throw food on the ground, no problem. It's like, yes, I see you're throwing food. It's saying, you know, that's not what we do in this house. But not needing to have the impatience that comes along with it. You know, it's sometimes there's an analogy around mindfulness anyway, that is kind of like training a puppy, you know, that we have to be gentle with the puppy. You know, the puppy, if you're trying to teach the puppy to not pee in the house, you need to be gentle. If you beat the puppy when it pees in the house, it's going to make more problems. So, you know, and to not have an aversion around it. It's more like, oh, just not there, here. Every time you notice it peeing someplace you don't want it to pee, you move the puppy. And so learning how to relate to our own minds in that way. It's like, oh, I wasn't mindful. You know, just, that's not a problem. Just here now. Just be here now. And likewise with your children. It's like, yeah, we don't do that in this house. And there are consequences when you do that. I'm going to, you know, whatever you choose as consequences for it. I mean, that's, I think, how we teach our children, so that we, you know, Here's the consequences of that behavior. But it doesn't have to come from impatience. It actually can come from more a sense of compassion for yourself, of you know, wanting your children. Well, there's the compassion for yourself around just not wanting to have that reactivity. And there's the compassion for your children, and knowing that if this is how they grow up and behave, that it will create some difficulty for them as they move out into the world and start engaging in social situations. So can you come from the place of compassion instead of impatience? And, you know, initially in that kind of exploration, It's okay, you know, there's the feeling of impatience. And can I just feel that impatience? Not trying to stuff it, because that will just tend to make it kind of, you're not paying attention to me. So noticing it. And what I like to do with that kind of thing is like, it's almost like playing a game. It's like, okay, yep, there's the impatience. I feel the impatience. And can I like not allow it to leak out into my behavior, into my tone of voice? Can I allow it to not leak out into my actions? It's kind of like being an actor, but clearly acknowledging, not trying to put on patience, but behaving in a way that you would if you were patient. And that actually has a rebound effect on the mind. And I've seen this in my own life, my own experience. When I do this, and impatience is a big one for me, when I choose to do this, when I remember to do this, like, okay, yep, I see this. I'm walking through the drugstore and I'm throwing things in my basket. So I need to do this quickly, and I'm impatient kind of, and just, you know. And I notice the behavior that's a manifestation of the emotion. And then, okay, I feel the emotion, but can I change the behavior? And that change of the behavior, not trying to repress the feeling, it's amazing to me how fast it alters the internal landscape within in that particular situation. And this was pretty minor impatience, I have to say, you know, in the drugstore. But it took less than a minute for that impatience to dissipate. And so that kind of a practice, acknowledging the impatience and seeing, okay, and now can I, you know, not allow this to leak out in my behavior? Thank you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So as I was sitting here, my cell phone was beeping, and so I got to have the experience of skillful remorse, and I could apologize to anyone around me. Normally I know to turn it off, but somehow I didn't today. So, and that's a reminder that sometimes it's so hard to, I was like, no, that's not mine. That can't possibly be mine. Of course I would turn mine off. And so sometimes just acknowledging a mistake.
Yes.
I mean, with a cell phone, you can't help but because you can look at a certain point and see. But most of life is not like that. And so to acknowledge a mistake and say, okay, I made this mistake, you know, and then not beat yourself up about it and just say, now I'll move on, and next time I should have a pattern.
Try again.
Yeah, maybe when I put my shoes away, that's right after that, I'll always check to make sure because I don't always remember what I did. So I just know that it's very hard to sometimes just look these mistakes straight in the eye. And then when you do look at them and just bring them out, to not beat yourself up and put yourself down. It's a very hard process. And one thing that's helped me in the past, and I don't know if this is something that you've done or think about doing, but sometimes I think, okay, if that were a friend that did that, no big deal. I would be very forgiving. It would not make a big deal, not even
yes.
think twice.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But when it's me, it's just like, oh my God, you know.
It's true. We judge ourselves way more harshly than others often do.
Yeah.
And that can be helpful to just acknowledge. Yeah, I wouldn't treat a friend this way. I wouldn't say you're stupid to my friend.
Yeah.
You know, I might point out, you know, that wasn't so helpful, but you know, the language, the harshness that we speak to ourselves, it's really strong. Now, another piece that you made me think of, you know, I in terms of looking at the skillful remorse, in my own, there was one time I you know, looking through this process of, okay, there's this action, it wasn't so skillful, and it was a small thing, you know, I had written a note to a fellow yogi on retreat, and we're asked not to do that. I had a reason to do it, but at the same time, you know, it was maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks into the retreat, and I left this note for this person, and I realized, you know, I don't know where they were. It might have been really disturbing for them to get this note. It was like, you know, we were having to arrange a flight to overseas together, and I had gotten some information, and I felt like I need to give him this information. It's like, you know, I felt you would not believe the small thing, leaving a friend a note, how many hours I spent telling myself what a bad person I was. You know, just hours and hours of that. And so I really got to look at it. And what I began to see was, well, I didn't really know how he responded to it, but at the same time, it could have been that it wasn't appropriate and that it would have been disruptive for his retreat to get this note. And so there was a sadness in me, you know, a feeling of, oh, I'm sad that might be what has happened for him. And when I finally got to the place where I could acknowledge, yes, that was not a good thing to do. I mean, I spent a while telling myself I needed to do that. I had to do that. He needed to know that. So I spent myself trying to tell myself it wasn't a mistake. I think we do that a lot. You know, it's like we try to convince ourselves that whatever it was we thought was a mistake wasn't a mistake. And finally I had to realize, no, you know, it was just not, I shouldn't have done that. So I could acknowledge the mistake. And when I got to that place, then, okay. And the feeling of the sadness, when I could touch into the sadness, a lot of the mental reactivity kind of dissipated. It's like, oh yeah, it's the sadness is a truth. It's kind of like the feeling of having potentially disturbed him brings a sense of sadness. And that was a skillful feeling. And it was much easier actually to be with that sadness and to acknowledge that I had made a mistake than it was to do all of these machinations around trying to convince myself I hadn't made a mistake or beating myself up around it. So that exploration, it can take some time, you know, to begin to tease apart all the different pieces, and then finally, you know, coming into the place of, okay, and what does it feel like to have made that mistake? You know, it feels like this to have made that mistake. So, yeah. Thank you.
I apologize to the people around me. Sorry. I do feel sad. Yeah.
And behind you.
I was sitting here and breathing, and I could hear the garbage truck outside as part of the oral composition, and it was writing on my breath, but I couldn't move my focus to the sound.
So you could feel them both together, but you couldn't...
I could do breath alone, and I could...
Have them together.
I could feel the composition integrated into my breathing, but I was really having trouble, you know, putting the sound a little bit forward.
And that's fine. I mean, you know...
And then I heard this noise that could have come from me. I have three devices that make that noise. One's in the car, one vibrates. The other one is at home. And for that moment, I was able to bring it forward, and not out of blame, but out of compassion, because it happens to everyone. And what I felt right away was, whoever that is, I hope they feel okay. But, you know, I don't think there's an apology thing that even needs to be addressed myself.
On the other hand, you know, it sometimes is, it's an expression for ourselves as much as it is for the others.
Yeah.
You know, and in what you said for your own experience around having difficulty bringing the sound forward, as I said, you know, all our minds are different. And so, you know, some people may have an ease with doing that and have trouble connecting with the breath. And I was mostly interested in kind of having this exploration of the two together, because that's an interesting place. It can really help, you know, if you're paying attention to the breathing, one of the main things that we get pulled out with is sound, you know, and judging around sound. So, you know, to be able to hold them together, it can be a really skillful piece. Yeah. Thank you. This is the last one.
Okay, this is easier for me to speak to than what you spoke about today. But with the breathing and the sound. Sometimes I have a ringing in my ear, I've noticed, when I get very quiet. And I like to use the ring in my ear as my grounding instead of breath.
Uh-huh.
But what I do find with the breath that is very different than listening to sounds and just identifying and knowing the sounds there is when I'm breathing, it takes me into my body more. The breath is like, it is me. And it's,
yes.
It brings me into feelings and emotions a little bit better than sounds. But I love listening and using a sound as my focal point or anchor. You know,
and did it work for you to use the sound with the breathing?
Was yeah, that and I didn't have a ring. It wasn't quiet enough to hear any ringing in my ear, so I did use the garbage truck or whatever it was. And I liked how you asked us to shift and maybe put that in the forefront and breathing secondary and switch back and forth. I like that a lot, and I'm able to do that. Mm-hmm. It would depend on my mood and where I'm at, which
exactly.
one I want to do.
Yes.
But because you were steering us towards things, I opened to that and did it, and it was good. It's good to know that I don't have to always do my breath.
Exactly. I mean, that's what I really wanted to point to here is that you know, there's kind of different ways in for different people, and different. All our minds are different, and so I'm liking to offer a wide variety of approaches for connecting with the breath, for connecting with other experience. And there was something you said that... it disappeared. It was about at different times feeling different ways. You know, that is definitely true. You know, at different times of the day, at different times of the different experiences were happening in our lives. We may be having a little more stress. Our minds have an easier time doing one thing or another, and so having a variety of tools at our disposal can help in that. So that we're not just stuck with thinking, okay, this is the way I have to be mindful. I have to pay attention to my breath. It was fine to pay attention to sound. You know, when that garbage truck was going by, it's like, well, you know, it's hard not to hear the garbage truck. Let's include that in the meditation. So, well, thank you. Thank you all.